My name's Andrew Jordan, I'll be chairing this session. The first speaker for this session will be Dr. Armin Guilian. Dr. Guilian is working with his PhD in the Landau Institute, right?
Yeah, yeah. The Lebedev Physics Institute.
The Lebedev Physics Institute, yeah. And he's working with Ginsberg at the time, a very famous physicist. Mm-hmm. And he's been working recently together with the institute that Jeff helped found with Professor Guilian at the Low Temperature Laboratory. And he's going to be talking about his work about using superconducting devices to detect all kinds of interesting things. And also you're going to be talking about the Aronoff Moln effect as well.
Thank you. It's a big honor for me to be here, and I am enjoying this conference. And as was said, my initial background was theoretical, but last, and I guess 35 years ago, the same day, I was defending my PhD thesis, so at PN Lebedev Institute. But last 20 years, I was mainly constrained by experimental work, and sometimes I am regretting it because theoreticians have much more freedom. At the same time, physics is a really experimental science, first of all, and it is worth sometimes to sacrifice some part of your life to get some results which will stay after you are gone. So the first part, and that because of that experimental constraint, it wasn't clear that I am coming at this meeting or not, and the very last moment it became possible. So Jeff asked me to do two presentations at once, and only half hour was available. So I need to do two presentations in approximately twice faster pace than others have done. And I'm sorry for a little bit poorly decorated presentation, but let's move forward. So yesterday already, it was interesting to hear some questions and comments about gravitational waves. And it's interesting that interesting questions have been asked, and I will try to add a little bit in my presentation to address these questions. So first of all, what is the physical action of gravitational waves? Probably the older generation knows about that much more than younger, but so many young people are here in the room that I decided to go into a little bit of details. So this is field lines of gravitational wave. It is supposed that gravitational wave is falling orthogonal to the plane of the screen. So, and then the field lines are changing their directions during the one period. So you can see the arrows of line. And if we will put test particles here, they will be doing this kind of motions. So it's hard to look long time on these fluctuations. So it's just time we should be grateful that interaction is so weak that we are not behaving like that. So I will go away from that, and let's just consider two particles. So if they are separated at distance, then the motion which they experience in the gravitational wave is sort of tidal motion under tidal forces. Like water in the oceans in the globe. So, interesting property is that the amplitude of motion or separation goes linearly with distance between particles. And this is a very simple relation, but it is a horrible one. And it is horrible because h, which is amplitude, dimensionless amplitude of gravitational waves, is very, very small. When about 40 years ago, I attended a lecture which Ginsburg asked me to go and participate, and Lev Grishuk, who later was working for LIGO in UK, he told us that, young guys, if you will be inventing detector, remember that if H naught, if your detector will not be able to handle H naught, you have no hopes. And these days when newspapers reported that LIGO indeed detected this particular number, amplitude was about 10 to the minus 21. I recalled in mind his words, how correct the professor was. So that is what is creating major problems. the smallness of this value, and this is for such a gigantic collapses like two black holes. But if you will consider rotations of a pulsar, for which we know frequency with very, very high accuracy, then the amplitude will be five orders of magnitude smaller. And it is not a joke, five orders of magnitude for experimentalists. So, which means that the deviation between mirrors, which in the interferometer LIGO should detect, is not bigger than 10 to the minus 18 of meters, 10 to the, for collapsing events, catastrophic events, and for regular events, it is even much smaller. So it is, since yesterday, the example was brought in about the angular accuracy of weak measurements, and I decided to give here an example. So if we will set up an angle of these two, these two dimensional quantities can constitute an angle. If we will make an arm as big as, say, distance from the moon, then we can find out how big will be this delta x. And the distance to the moon is very well known. I rounded it up to 400,000 kilometers. So it will then come out that gravitational wave requires not one human hair accuracy in angular resolution if the arm will be from here to the moon, but 10 to the minus, it will be smaller by a factor 10 to the minus 8, which is when Jeff is sometimes asking me, let's go ahead and think how can we apply weak measurement to this, I am telling Jeff it is too early. We need to move forward with weak measurements more. So we need factor of billion improvement to be able to compete with what is going on in this arena. So, but nevertheless, leaving weak value, weak measurements alone for a time, how can we beat the smallness of H naught? It is small number, as I said, coming close to 10 minus 30. So let's try to see if we can beat it with big number of charge carriers in materials, because we know that it is also surprisingly big how many charge carriers we have in metals. So that is one orientation to move towards. Then the second, if we will use superconductors, which are Bose condensates, or close relatives to Bose condensates, we will have much less noise than we have with lasers. And here we have infinitely long, almost infinitely long coherence time for superconductors. Then, if detector will be small, then obviously you can orient it as you want, and you can easily put that on the orbit, and you can orient it or in the lab, even you can orient it. But LIGOs are capital buildings, and it is impossible to move them. But we still can leverage from the achievements which LIGO achieved, like they can isolate seismic noise by a factor of 10 to the 10, so even more. So that will be interesting for, I think John yesterday was complaining that he cannot move around, but he need to take probably the advantages which LIGO already is using. Then if sizes are small, you can easily neutralize moon and sun, and it is easy to understand why, because if your detector is of size of this room, you can, and sun is on that end, you can ask somebody to stand oppositely, but much closer than sun, and he will, and then move with opposite to the sun's movement, and you can, in principle, it is doable, especially if we will use computers with digital programs. So, but one thing we need to keep in mind, never fight with Coulomb interaction. Coulomb interaction should not prohibit any motion which you are considering with your gravitational wave detector. So that is, I think, why poor Professor Weber wasn't successful, because in his case there were some forces when there were oscillations in the body which were Coulomb, in their origin, Coulomb forces. So if we will do that, then keep that in mind. Let's consider this is, I plotted here field lines. So for one given sign of direction. So now we see what is going on. If say you have particle here and particle here, free particles, they will move apart from each other. And these guys will come closer to each other. And if, suppose that we have a solid, which is a circle. So we will see that the circle will stay immobile. It will, of course, deflect a little bit, but it is again Coulomb forces against gravitational forces. It is immeasurable. So the circle of material body will just not move around its center of mass. But can we do it moving? How can we do that? In principle, we can. And for that to be the case, we need to make it having a quadrupolar momentum. Suppose that, say, this quadrant has a different mass than this quadrant, and this quadrant has the same mass as this one, then easy to see that this quadrant will try to move clockwise, so that the circle will try to rotate this way, and this quadrant will assist it, but these guys will oppose. So if their masses if it is geometrically symmetric body, the density, if I will take the density of the material here smaller here and here than in these two quadrants, then the circle will move. Now we are getting by this an opportunity to convert action of gravitational waves into circular rotation of the body. This is important because this is not what LIGO is doing. LIGO is just trying to measure longitudinal motion of the mirrors. And we are converting first it into the, and the mass can be as big as you want because you can design accordingly so that you will have enough coupling of the body with the gravitational wave. So it's easy to understand that it will be performing oscillatory oscillations. So it will move clockwise and counterclockwise, and the task will be then to measure the this rotation. And it's the artistic picture is plotted here, so you see different masses pairwise and field lines. And suppose that you have made this out of superconductor, then ions will be coupled much stronger with much stronger force with gravitational waves than electrons, than Cooper pairs. So and suppose that Cooper pairs are homogeneously distributed everywhere, but not ions, which will mean that, as I said at the very beginning, Cooper pairs will not move, but ions will be accelerated. So we will induce current, oscillatory current in this torus. Suppose that it is covered by superconducting layer homogeneously on the surface. So we will have current flowing there. And in that moving system of coordinates, we will have AC current, and it will generate some magnetic flux, which can be picked up by immobile coil and amplified by squid. So it's very interesting to see, if you will substitute this number, that if we would be able to have the whole cross-section following filled by Cooper pairs moving relative to the ions, then the current is very easily detectable, even in case when H naught is five orders of magnitude smaller than LIGO's H naught. So it is of femtoamp scale, for much smaller than 10 to the minus 21 amplitude of gravitational waves. But unfortunately, that is not the case, and there are problems. Problems are first of all related with the fact that only London penetration depths will allow Cooper pairs to move. You cannot have quasi-DC current inside of the bulk superconductor. That is one problem. Second problem is that there is a magnetic field which you need to take into account when dealing with with this kind of situations. So it is still some way to go. I don't want to go into the details, despite we spend about 4-5 years considering this scheme. But one thing I will say, that in laboratory implementation, in principle, you can make this, as I said, a toroidal construction. It may be even hollow, and it may fly in the helium, which will be in the external torus, inside of the external torus here. And if it is superfluid, you will have almost no friction, and you will have no Coulomb blockade of your gravitationally induced motion. So that is, we call it helium submarine in our laboratory jargon. But there are other ways for signal acquisition. It is not necessarily to have that inertial motion of Cooper pairs in the ionic lattice. In principle, as I said, magnetic field can be a prohibition there. So we decided to try to use the magnetic field in favor of the design. So suppose that you have magnetic field, because majority of people here are theoreticians, they can easily calculate what I did here, just to reproduce that. If we will take 10 by 10 meter frame, this is galvanometer type design. You have a straight DC magnetic field, and you have a frame with some windings which is parallel to the magnetic field. And if you will see how much flux change can gravitational wave introduce into your galvanometric winding here, you will see that for one winding, it will be about, in case of smallest limit, 10 to the minus 26 for pulsar, it will be about 10 to the minus 8 phi naught. And one squid, one DC squid purchased off shelf, can deliver 10 to the minus 6. So if you will measure per second, sensitivity is 10 to the minus 6 per second. So if you will wait 10 to the 4 seconds, which is 3 hours, you will take pulsar signal out of the noise. Or you can use 10 to the 4 squids, which in principle is doable, even millions is possible to put in one detecting array. And then you will do that faster than a second. But again, this is just the principle. It is not details. It's any detector requires very, as LIGO demonstrated, decades. It took decades to fight the noise. And I guess the same will be here, but the game is worth to play. So this is the end of the first part, and we have now the rest. So we are preparing some proposals to different agencies, and this one of the agencies already peer-reviewed and accepted it, but that is not directly for gravitational waves, but rather for a cat, which can be detected at a 1 kilometer distance. And we actually were thinking about people in some distance, but it turned out that we can detect a cat. Okay, so now, second part, for which we have about 10 minutes. This is a little bit different story. And this was discussed multiple times with Yakir. And Yakir actually discouraged me to undertake this work, because he was afraid that experiment will show negative results. Mm-hmm. However, even if it will show negative result, it will be interesting, but it will be even more interesting, it will show positive results. And I will explain what is going on. While still being a theoretician, I was amazed how current in superconductors is proportional to the vector potential. In classical physics, that is prohibited. There cannot be any quantity which is proportional to the vector potential. But in explanation of Meissner effect, one of the geniuses on whose shoulders the physics of superconductivity was built, Fritz Landon, he proclaimed this relation and was able to explain Meissner effect. Now, later, when BCS theory was published, they were criticized that their theory is not gauge invariant, because they just confirms that this equation takes place in some particular gauge in their theory. And the community was demanding to make this gauge invariant. And in principle, gauge invariance is there in quantum mechanical expression for the wave, for the current in quantum mechanics. You just need to take the wave function, and then the current is wave function plus gradient of the phase of your wave function. And this you can also see easily in Ginzburg-Landau theory. Second equation by Ginzburg and Landau has this relation. But now if we will, and everybody is using it. And it is good, it is working very well. However, if we will start thinking what is going on, this is a quantity which is, this belongs to the field, external field, and Carlos, this is giving you H. This belongs to the object, I mean the superconductor. So we are adding apples to oranges, which is fine. There are other physical quantities when you add apples to oranges. But now if we will see what is going on when we will do gauge transformation, which means that we are taking our gauge function and making gauge transformation over the vector potential, immediately superconductor reacts. So, which means that superconductor, in some language, you can say that superconductor feels or senses what's going on with the vector potential. So I would say in normal human language that quantum objects can feel the vector potential. And the problem is why this is so important. It is important because of the following. Suppose that we have a situation, suppose this is a strip, so let it be superconducting strip, and we put current here. So current flows non-zero, that means that we will have vector potential in parallel to the current. So we have vector potential here. Now, can we use another superconductor and fill this vector potential? And the answer, yes, Meissner effect is one of them. A Meissner effect is doing that, but at the same time, Meissner effect has closed trajectory. So if I will take, say, squid loop and try to measure existence of current in here, I will see. I can take it out, and my strip is now here, and my loop is here. And I will still see it because there is magnetic field. This kind of vector potential for the strip with current is creating vector potential which Carl is not zero, it is H. So squid can see H, and it is not paradox. And but now I will take Aronov bomb potential. If I will take solenoid instead of this line, then I will again have vector potential, but not magnetic field. And the experiment shows that if I will do that, and this, see what is the situation. I have my solenoid, I have my superconducting loop, and I'm cooling down. Initially, it was above. For solenoid, it was fine, it was superconducting, but for this other superconductor, it was above critical temperature. Now I am cooling it down, and when my temperature is becoming lower than critical temperature of this material, superconducting current is setting up here. And that is what experiment shows. Now I am asking, very good, let's consider that nobody is opposing non-locality of quantum physics, but can I make a statement that magnetic field inside of solenoid non-locally acting and creating current in this superconducting loop? How are we getting that energy out to there? So, which means that maybe in reality, well, either you should say that energy somehow is being transferred or it is being taken from another source. But in any case, presence of vector potential here is very important. And the task is, can we, if the loop is closed, then we can always use Stokes' theorem and calculate this current and so on. And the question, the principal question is how we are getting the energy is still open. And I have some answers for that. But suppose that I will now take not closed loop, but everything is the same, but I'm cutting the loop. Can we put forward an idea for an experiment which can determine any changes in this superconducting material? That that is a problem. So which easiest answer is no, a harder answer is yes. And for that harder answer, you should be responsible. That's why I put here myself as a sole author, because I don't want to hurt the reputation of other people. but this was, the idea was published some years ago, and we discussed with Yakir, and I dedicated it to his 80th birthday. So, and see what you can do. It is not very straightforward, and it is not yet proven, it is not yet written in stone, but it is just a working hypothesis. Suppose that you have a superconducting, I have a couple of more minutes, so you have a superconducting strip which is creating that vector potential, as I said. And you have second superconducting material nearby, in parallel, so that vector potential can affect. My first task will be forget about Aronoff-Bohm potential for a while. Let's first consider, can we take non-looped geometry and detect vector potential by non-looped geometry when you are not using Stokes' theorem, you are not able to apply Stokes' theorem to this and express the answers through the magnetic field. And the task is the following. You have one superconducting line and second superconducting. This is generator of your A field. This is a detector. The rest is normal metal. So very interestingly, what is going on? This circuit is nonlinear. It is called charge tank. So it is absolutely symmetrical. And when I am applying AC voltage, we will go ahead and charge this or that capacitor. So we can measure potential difference between these two ends. So the question is, if current is moving this way or that way, would there be any difference? That is a possible, if this will work for this situation, the next will be to try to detect Aronoff-Bohm potential, because principally that is vector potential in both cases. So, and the first modeling which we did reveals that yes, there will be a difference. So nonlinearity is important. And I have no time to go into the details, but whoever is interested, I am here for a couple of more days, and Jeff is available too. So please, let's have a discussion. And probably now I should tell that that is why I wasn't able to come, because there is a lot of laboratory work. It is, with bare hands, you cannot demonstrate anything. You need to have high technology to be able to address the hard tasks. So this is end, and maybe time for a couple of questions. But yeah.
Okay. So we have time for a couple of questions, indeed. Hello?
So in this configuration, there is a magnetic field from one from another, or no magnetic field?
In this one? In this one?
Yeah.
In this one, yeah, if you have current flowing this, you have magnetic fields.
Here there is no one. And
yes, yes, yes.
Singular gauge which come out of this
correct.
Hole. And
correct.
Then nothing's supposed to happen.
But vector potential is present in no, both cases.
It can now go through the hole. You can have a gauge when you have this line of vector potential. And where is this? In the place of superconductor, there is nothing.
Let me understand better the question.
Which is through this the vector potential come out, and no vector potential.
Oh no, vector potential is in the space. In the space.
There are different gauges. In one of the gauges, it can go through the hole.
Consider that gauge.
So then.
Because if you will change gauge, my superconductor will sense it. You cannot play with the gauge. living superconductor.
The wave function will be changed, but your superconductor will feel nothing. Of course, when you change your gauge, the wave function goes to the changes together. This is what's going on, but nothing physical will change. Current in any place will change.
No, it is if again that is easy answer. But that much I understand.
I mean,
also. but nature is harsh.
No.
Oh yes, it is.
I want to believe that nature is.
Unfortunately, it is harsh. As Tony Leggett was telling the other day, the time will come when we will understand that quantum mechanics is being replaced by something else, and maybe this will somehow help to understand that, because like. I will give one example. Since the problem is very, a question is very physical, I will give you one very physical answer. We can have in physics a situation similar to this. Suppose that you have a piece of ice, and that piece of ice, we would like it to be melted. And we all know that for the piece of ice to melt, you need to warm it up, and you need to bring energy to. Yes, you can do that, and it will melt. But there is another way. You can take a bucket of salt and put it on top of the ice, in which case poor ice will melt and it will absorb heat from the surrounding area, from the air, for example. Well, living many years in Moscow, I felt on my skin it many times. When you are going through the place where they put salt, it is much colder because they enforce. So the vector potential may play a role of. It may not give any energy, but energy may be taken out of, I don't know which kind of fluctuations or which kind of thermal energy surrounding this superconductor. So it is very, very hard task. It is not simple, believe me, but it is worth to try from my point of view.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.